So again, we're very glad to see all present. Each one is very warmly welcome, and we trust the Lord's blessing will be upon us as we consider His Word. And we're still in the book of Ruth, as you know, and still in chapter 1. Chapter 1 of the book of Ruth, commencing to read at verse 3. In chapter 1, verse 3, it says here down to verse 13, but and Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. Malon and Chilion died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return unto the land of Judah. Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you, as ye have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant you that ye may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said unto her, Surely we will return with thee unto thy people. And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters. Why will ye go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have an husband. If I should say, I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight, and should also bear sons, would ye tarry for them till they were grown? Would ye stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord is gone out against me. Maybe we should read verse 14 as well. And they lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. I think that may be enough for our consideration. We trust the Lord blessing upon His Word. I imagine that nearly everything that I wanted to say, as far as general things were concerned, we covered them last night, and I don't want to repeat the matters that were mentioned in a rather lengthy introduction. So that tonight I'm just intending to give a brief comment or two, and then we can leave the meeting open for the helpful comments of our brethren. I think it was one of our own poets, Longfellow, who said that defeat can sometimes disguise victory. And the lowest ebb is the turning of the tide. Well, certainly there's a sense in which that last expression fits what we have read tonight. The lowest ebb in the book also became the turning of the tide. We thought last night about a number of those steps that took Elimelech and his family far away, and they come down to just rock bottom, and then things begin to turn, and we can see the hand of the Lord in a very remarkable way. Now when you get to verse 3, you notice there's a little change in the sense that in verse 1 and 2, the mover, the actor, the man that had the initiative was Elimelech. But when you get to verse 3, it changes because it tells us that she was left. And it tells us, verse 6, she arose with her husband. Verse 8, and Naomi said, and quite a number of other verbs as well. So that Naomi now becomes the main person in the chapter as far as human beings are concerned. Elimelech is fading off the scene, and our attention is focused upon this woman. As far as the content of the little paragraph that we have read tonight, I just highlight very quickly a number of important points that maybe we could keep in mind. We think about the tragedy that she suffered. It was devastating, to say the least. Her husband died, and then the two boys died, and she was left just without a home. When they'd left Bethlehem Judah, without a husband, without an heir, and the woman has just come to the very rock bottom, as I say, of poverty, the tragedy that she suffered. She never thought that the move to Moab would lead to those marriages in Moab. And she never thought that the marriages would lead to monuments in Moab, or to such mourning in Moab. But it does show us that once you get off the rails, things can really become derailed, and quite a wreckage can follow. The tragedy that she suffered. Then when we get to verse number 6, the tidings that she heard. Suddenly, into the experience of this woman, there comes tidings of better things from the very land that she has left. The Lord is blessing again amongst this people. And the heart of Naomi, it appears, is touched. In fact, it appears to me as if her heart had never really left that land. And now that she hears of the presence and blessing of the Lord, his covenant faithfulness, the Lord, Jehovah, has visited his people in giving them bread, she decides it's time to get out of here. And we think not only about the tidings that she heard, but the trip that she planned. She didn't hear just the tidings and think, now that's good, then maybe I should think about heading back. She actually arose. Verse number 6 tells us, she arose. And she actually put it into action, her intention to get back to Bethlehem, Judah. It's great to find people that have wandered away, turning their head and turning their hearts towards home. And there is a road back, and that's the road that we will see particularly tomorrow night in the latter part of the chapter, as far as Naomi is concerned. And in her coming back, we'll be intrigued also to see that there was the two that she brought. And in fact, just with that, the testimony that she had. To me, it's a very amazing thing that when she decided to leave Moab, the two girls were willing to come with her. It shows, at the very least, the high respect in which they held their mother-in-law, that they were prepared to leave the land of their nativity, the land with which they had so many connections, and these two girls, they embarked upon what was to them an unknown pathway, to travel to an unvisited country, all because of the testimony of a woman who had lived amongst them for 10 years, maybe in disobedience, but nevertheless, I think that these girls had seen something in the life and character of Naomi that had impressed them to at least a certain degree. And then we'll be considering, as we go down the verses a little bit further, the tests that she applied. Because Naomi presented to these girls a number of, I suppose we could call them hurdles. It would almost appear to just an onlooker that she didn't make it easy for them. She set out the problem. She faced the difficulties that they would inevitably encounter. She didn't paint a rosy picture. And she presented to them tests. After the first test, she told them in the first test, she says, listen, you have a far safer going back to familiar ground. You know Moab in your mother's house, and you'll be comfortable there. It would be far easier for you to spend the rest of your days in that country. It would be materially advantageous, rather than come away with me into a land where you are unknown, and where to a great extent Moabites will be unwelcome. So a few tears. Then there came the second test. And she pressed it a little bit further. She said, no, I can't give you any promise of marriage. She said, it would be better for you materially if you would go back to Moab. It would also be better for you matrimonially if you go back to Moab. She says, just what Moabite girls would be wanting a comfortable time with a husband and so on, you'll get that far more to suit your Moabite estate down there. The second test, 2 Peter. But then, there's one of those girls, and she has more than just thoughts of material comfort. And she has more in her mind than just matrimonial connection. Her heart has been won to the God of Israel, and we'll be talking about her tomorrow evening. And when the third test came, one of the girls passed the third test and went with Naomi, as we'll be discovering. Sadly, the other girl, she just turned back, disappeared, and as you very well know, we never hear of her again. It seems to me that Naomi was a woman, and whatever we say about her, we begin to get a glimpse of her character. She really had a heart for Bethlehem, Judah. And she really had a heart to know that if people are going to come amongst God's people, it is going to last. We are going to need reality. And she wasn't trying to put them off. She was just testing them for the reality of their profession, for the depth of their conviction. And it's sort of them out, as we discover as we go down the passage. Now that's a very sketchy outline. The tragedies you suffer, the tidings you heard, the trip you planned, the tool that you brought, the testimony she had, the tests she applied, the tears that she witnessed, and the turning of Orpah at just the end of this little paragraph. Now you would say, when we come to a section like this, what exactly are the lessons that we could carry over to our present day? Well, we emphasized a good wee bit last night in the meeting, the importance of making right choices and the consequences of making wrong choices. And I think that still holds, in fact, right through the chapter. I would say you could put over Ruth chapter 1, the consequences of choices. With the choice of Elimelech to move. We'll not be going back over that ground. He has moved. That was last night's considered. Then you have the choice of the two boys to marry. That was a bad choice. To marry Moabitish women. To enter into an unequal yoke. Then you have the choice of Naomi to come back. Wrong choice. Then you have a choice of Orpah to go back. Then you have the choice of Ruth to press on. So we have five distinct choices that are clearly delineated, and every one of those choices had very far-reaching consequences. And we can learn at least this lesson in a very general way, that the choices that we make will really impact our lives and will make a mark upon us and will mould us and shape us. We are tonight, what you are tonight and what I am tonight, under the grace of God and the good hand of God, we are the sum total tonight of the choices that we have made right down the line. I'm the product of the choices for which I am responsible. Those choices can be good or for ill. They can be positive or negative. We all make choices at every juncture of life. And may God help us to learn. Here are people just in an ordinary rural setting. Just people living in a country area. And they are making choices which centuries later will still be sending ripples down the line. Just as we keep in mind, as we sit, I sit down and we go into the passage, we can also keep in mind that one of the things that Ruth will be teaching us in a big way, and the beginnings of it are seen in this part of that, that even though humans do fail, and even though there are serious blunders, and even though there is downright disobedience, that the failure of man can never thwart the plan of God. And God is overruling, and he's taking flawed human beings. And even in their broken life, do you say, do you mean if I make a mistake, I write myself out of the plan of God? Well, with a wrong choice, you might. You know, Elimelech wrote himself out. And the two boys wrote themselves out. But you say Naomi's implicated as well. Well, in actual fact, Naomi, even though she was implicated in the failure of the family, God overruled in such a way that Naomi still had a role to play and a place to fill and a very special plan to contribute to as a mother-in-law. And it could be that some of us have made mistakes. That does not necessarily mean failure is final. There can still be recovery. And the fact that God can overrule our mistakes does not excuse our failure. It only serves to magnify His marvelous repairing grace. So, we're talking now about these three women, primarily, a little bit before we get to that, and I trust the Lord will help us as we go through the verses one by one. Now that's a good bit shorter than last night, so it gives plenty of time for them to contribute and help us through on the details of the passage. Do feel free, brother, to come in with your contributions.
Stephen, I don't want to provide over ground to that last night.
Yes, Stephen.
Moab is very prominent in these first verses that we read.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would know places in Scripture that speak sometimes of world systems that are in opposition to God and to the believer,
mm-hmm.
you have Egypt and Satan's rule of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You have Sodom and the uncleanness of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You have Babylon and the religious world. With Noah, here be the world and it's all its allurements, its attractions, its appeal to the flesh, the world of self-indulgence, the world of ease, the world of pleasure and prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what attracted these people down into Noah. Wasn't it? You know, Eve, the source of the flesh, shall reap corruption.
Yeah.
And as you said, there were tears and tragedy according to the choice they made. But maybe it's good to know what Moab speaks of.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks of the allurements and the attractions to the flesh of his image that appeals to us when we are living carnally and dead to the spirit, isn't it?
You see, you have mentioned some places there. Moab wasn't just as far away. They didn't go away to Babylon. And they didn't go way, way, way down into Egypt. Yesterday. 50 miles across. 40 miles over the Jordan. Handy. Not hundreds of miles away. Sometimes there are certain forms of the word, grosser forms of confusion and corruption. We wouldn't go to those extremes, but we don't mind taking a wee visit to a sector of the world that's closer. And our brother has mentioned Moab and its ease. You know, the prophet Isaiah said, Moab has been at ease from his youth, hasn't been emptied from vessel to vessel, settled upon its legs, representing that word of ease, luxury, indolence. You know, the big fat man of the book of Judges, Eglon. His name means a calf, great big calf of a man. Just fed on the fat of Moab, lolled about in his great big summer house, and just enjoyed himself. That's just Moab. That's just Moab. Now we need to watch. We mightn't go to the world of Egypt or Babylon, but as Christians, especially middle class Christians, we could be tempted just to slip over into the world of ease, trendy pleasure, and indulgent luxury. And find yourself looking for their pleasure in the very things that the man of the world enjoys. So they weren't too far away, but they were still over the Jordan, out of the land of God's inheritance. Thanks for that.
Not to take you back there, David, you mentioned that someone left now, it's not the prime mover. It's not the prime mover now from now on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Naomi as his wife she wouldn't have been the prime mover going down to Moab, do you think, David? Or was it the head of the home?
Oh no, I think somebody, we mentioned last night that in his position of leadership, he took the whole family. I know that later on, we'll be discovering tomorrow night, when she's talking about it, she doesn't say, I would never have been there, only he took me. She says, I without both. She takes her share of the blame. That's tomorrow night. But at the same time, at the beginning of the chapter, I think it's the man taking the family, and as a dependent woman, she may have had misgivings, she may not have made any great big objections. I just wonder how happy she ever was. And certainly when she was there, I don't think she was very comfortable as things began to unfold.
When David the sojourn and then the continued and they dwelt, those three words we have in these verses.
So you nearly think you're getting a wee bit more sucked in. That's right. That's what happens. That's what happens. We make, you know, that's a thing here, Christians, we need to watch. You hear about somebody having a collapse and everybody's aghast. Well, I'll tell you this. Whatever happened there didn't happen overnight. Departure is by stages. You take a liberty. You go for curiosity. They just slip in once. There's curiosity. Then that leads to further visits. Then that becomes more addictive. And before you know, as our brother is saying, you go to surgery, then you stay a while, and then you're actually dwelling there. You're becoming settled. And we always need to watch the subtle seepage of worldly things into our hearts, taking us away.
You know, you mentioned that suggested that Naomi's heart was never in war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was herself.
Mm-hmm.
She stayed years after her husband died. We know that. And as you said, she didn't spare herself later on in the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But why does she go back to Judah?
You see, we're maybe jumping just a wee section ahead here, Sammy. We're into verse 6, and we've started at verse 3. The passage tells us that she went back for she heard. She heard that the Lord had visited his people and given them bread. The passage goes out of its way, if I may say that, to tell us that she didn't leave Moab because of the vexation of losing three male members of her family. It wasn't the hardships of Moab that drove her out, not the vexation of the bereavement. It was the visitation of bread. She went back, not because she wants to get away from these burials. She goes back because she hears the Lord has visited his people in giving them bread. You know, what brings a Christian back is not just smarting under God's governmental dealing. It's being melted by signs of God's grace. That's what makes
you different. Isn't it very similar next to the prodigal? He thought of the father's house and says, isn't there really nothing to spare? Without perish with hunger. Like Naomi here, he says, I will arise. She arose, she did something about it.
That's it. How many hard servants of my father have bread enough? And he didn't say, I'm fed up with these husks. This is dry enough. No. It was thinking back to the better that then he left them, and the same with here. She arose when she heard it, that the Lord had visited
her. What would have made her stay for 10 years? Family ties, attractions to the family. You know, Abraham, he only went so far because of his father. You know, there's things in restoration for a believer, but because of their ties to their family or something else, it holds them back from being restored.
Could have been, Stephen, or you never know, going back to what we're just saying and to what the passage says, maybe the famine lasted. And as soon as she heard the bread baskets filling again, she knew that the Lord's blessings amongst his people, and that's where I would need to be.
But the famine seems to end after the sons die, doesn't it, in the chapter? You know, there when you cared for it, the sons have died.
Do you think that she had heard that there was blessing and still stayed for a good wife? I thought when she heard she moved.
But like the brother Sammy says, her heart was never really in Moab. And, you know, there was something still keeping her in Moab, was it family ties, attachments? Because it seems to be the mention of the famine being over and there was bread in Bethlehem, Judah.
Uh-huh.
After the sons had died, going to the chapter. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure. Well, maybe we should just look at that. Verse number 3, where was that? You notice that Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left. And then they have the marriage, we'll talk about that in a second. Then they dwelled there for 10 years. Verse number 5, the two boys died, both of them. That's emphasized. The two boys died, both of them died. And again, the women were left. No, there were three women left. But the woman was left. So she was left in verse 3. But she was left in an even worse state in verse number 5. The woman was left of her two sons and her husband. So the thing's just going from bad to worse. And then verse number 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return, for she had her. Now what about the marriage of the boys? Do we want to say anything about that in verse number 4? Before they took them. So the father died. And now the boys go ahead, and just a bit like their father, they make their own decision. And they made their choice of women of Moab. And the two names are there, and settled down for 10 years.
Can you just the age of the boys when they left, Judah? What age they would have been when they left?
You see,
would it take them time, that 10 years, for them to call that age for
marriage and so on? It could. You see, it depends. It depends where just you put the 10 years in. In that passage, look at verse number 3. The man died, then the two boys get married in verse 4, and then they dwell there about 10 years. It nearly seems to me, and I wouldn't push it because some of it, that the two boys got married and the 10 years was after their marriage. You know, so it's just, the big thing is this, I would say if you've been talking to any one of us, to the limit or anyone, as our brother David has mentioned, if you've been telling them they're going to tell me, yeah, about, oh, we'll be back shortly. We'll just go down here and get out of this tight corner. We not belong to our back. Never thought three of them would never come back. I never thought that a full decade. I was speaking to a man not so long ago that was 13 years out of an assembly fellowship. Through nothing desperate, serious or big, a little bit of a disagreement, and he lost the head and just marched out and so on. You know the type of thing that can happen just in a week. But he told me, he says, David, I thought I'd be back within a few weeks. He says, never thought of the 13 years. Always remember, it's a big lesson for us all. It's a good wee bit handier getting out than it is getting back. Just keep that in mind before you jump out. Adam and Eve learned at the start it was handier getting out than it is getting back in. And that holds true in many different stages of life. So the 10 years, that always hits me with an awful sense of loss. 10 years! Just the way down in the land of Moab.
Would you have thought, David, after Elimelech died, that the sons would have said to themselves, is this the judgment of God upon us? We should be going back here instead of staying.
I often thought that day, you know, I thought it would have been a signal, like what a joke to them. But then you see, you never know, you never know. You see, the father didn't seem to have much concern about principle, because he left. He didn't concern about saying the talent team, he just left and did what he liked. So the boys would say, my dad didn't worry much about principle, we shouldn't worry much about the mother. He left the land, we could just leave it, we could marry him. We can leave the Lord and marry these two Moabitish girls. Just let us watch the unequal yoke as well. That's another thing. That's another thing. When you go to the place where they live, where the Moabites live, if you frequent where they live, it's very, very possible that you get a Moabitish wife or a Moabitish husband. We all need to watch that. Visits to Moabite places can lead to marriages, to Moabitish people. The father left the land and died. The two boys married Moabitish women and they died. So that we can see you can make your own choice, but getting away from God's chastisement mightn't just be as easy.
Can I give a little
fun one? Sure. Go ahead, Tommy. Tommy, you go ahead.
Just on that, David, very often we read, there was nothing wrong with the Mary and Moabites.
Mm-hmm.
Was there? Obviously, you know, these people said it wasn't against the law of the covenant that they married Moabites.
Uh-huh.
But if we read Numbers chapter 25, you have the heart for that to see that it was
according
in the purpose
to the mind of
God.
And even Nehemiah chapter 12, Nehemiah chapter 13, and Nehemiah's day later on. I mean, you should just look at that, just so it's sure they don't. Nehemiah chapter 13, as well as the passage that our brother Sammy has mentioned. Chapter 13 of Nehemiah, verse 1 says, on that day they read the book of Moses, and therein was found written that the Ammonite and Moabite should not come into the congregation of God forever, because they met not the children of Israel, and so on. Verse 3, it came to pass when they heard the law, they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude. So that it wasn't acceptable in Nehemiah's day. And I think we just need to, you know, Moab, our brother Stephen was referring to that. Moab was a wretched country as far as a very pagan worship was concerned. And Naomi knew about it, but she said about Orpah later on, she's gone back to her gods. And back to her idolatry and all of that. I can't see that these marriages have the blessing of the Lord because of their mixture. Stephen, you were
there. Responding
over
the way the governmental dealings with God, with Naomi.
Uh-huh.
So God taking away the two sons, but he's taken away the obstacle, the hindrance, for her to be restored. That's what the thought was. You know, the attachments to the family, I didn't want to hammer that. You know, that's my thought. He removed them governmentally.
Aye.
So that Naomi could be restored. There was nothing there to keep her in Moab anymore.
Okay.
That was my thought.
I see that, Stephen. I maybe hadn't just seen that as much as removing obstacles as just the Lord bringing. In a sense, she had lost her home. As I said, she lost her husband and she lost the heir. Now, the three things that she lost were the three things that Boaz provided. He gave Ruth a home. He became for Ruth a husband. And he provided Ruth with an heir. So that I thought, I was thinking more than removing obstacles, it could be that it was more telling us that these deaths brought this woman down to a state of absolute hopelessness. You know, a woman in ancient culture without a male member in the family was absolutely stranded. The breadwinners are gone. All of them. Not just her husband, but these two boys. It's a situation that's absolutely hopeless. There's not a ray of hope in it. Three women and not a man to be seen. Not a breadwinner on the face of the whole family. Then she hears that there is a bread supply. And she has no man to provide bread. She hears that the Lord has visited his people in giving them bread. And she says there's still grace there's still grace and provision and blessing with the Lord. But we need to watch, as you say, that family connections don't play with us on June 9th.
Marriage in the Lord, you were talking about an equal yoke. But take it that goes further. Take it that goes further than just two Christians in an assembly or assembly fellowship getting married, because you could get married. A Christian in an assembly, and it would be anything but a marriage in the Lord. You may stay within the assemblies, but it could be anything but a marriage in the Lord. But it'd be right there.
And we'll see a good bit more. If you want to get a sample of a marriage in the Lord, taking the Lord's interest into account, we'll certainly see that before the book ends, like with those. A virtuous man and a virtuous woman. We'll get a good wee bit more of that maybe in chapter 3. Now, what about this tidings? The tidings that she has heard, these are the tragedies. Now the tidings has come. Are there better times, God visiting his people? That's a beautiful expression, isn't it? We couldn't we do with a visitation or two from the Lord? You know, there's nothing. There's nothing encourages, even gives sinners, brought in Ruth, blessing to a sinner, and restoration of a wanderer like Naomi, just like hearing that the Lord was bountifully blessing his people, visiting his people. Right from the very first occurrence of that, the book of Genesis, it's a great encouragement, right to your reading, that the day spring from on high had visited us.
You mentioned the title of the book, you have the title of Jehovah in the book. It's worth noticing as well, isn't it? Seven times in this first chapter we have the Lord mentioned in these verses, four in this section, which we're in, and three in the next section.
That's very good. Yeah, and we'll see it, especially tomorrow night. Again, is there are seven people mentioned by name in Ruth 1. There's Elimelech and Naomi, the two boys and the two girls, Orpah and Ruth. Six human beings, and then the seventh person that's mentioned by name is the Lord, and he's mentioned seven times. And the story of the six people would have been a very sad story, with a very dull ending, had it not been for the seventh person who moves. You know, dear Christians, we have to admit, we blunder about through life, and we plunder about, and we make mistakes, and we get into fixes. Where would any of us have been tonight, had it not been for the Lord's providence, and the Lord's mercy, and the Lord overruling our blunders? You know, some of us think we just hardly ever made a mistake. And some of us are big fellas, and we think everybody else makes mistakes but us. Listen, there's not a person in this hall tonight hasn't made as many mistakes as would sink half a nation. We're all blunderers, and had it not been for God's overruling grace, who knows where we might have ended, or what, how sad the story. The Lord, this is the first mention, and God, but the Lord, who has six people mentioned now, some of them in very shaky circumstances. Now the seventh one comes in, and he's the perfect remedy to a very sad situation.
The decision of the father can affect the lives of the children. On what path they're taking, but also, if you refer that to the assembly, the actions of an overseer, would you say it could be the same way a young believer if they're going on that?
Oh, it can very much. We mentioned last night again that part of the teaching in the book is leadership, and whether it's leadership in the nation is here, the days of the judges govern, whether it's leadership in the family, we apply the leadership in the assembly or leadership. That was a good decision. Her husband's bad decision had impacted others. Her good decision, likewise. Like, I love that expression in verse number 7. She went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went. She was obviously the prime mover. They went on the way to return onto the land of Judah. So here's a good decision. Surprisingly influential two girls.
Yeah, but go on and present these people. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Present these people. And giving them bread. Just to get back to the point, there was plenty of bread in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that famine lasted 10 years in Israel. I doubt that it did, but mm-hmm. I don't know. But there was plenty of bread in Noah. Now I only heard the tidings of the shed. Bread, God visited people with bread. I don't think, and I mean you'll agree, I know everybody will, that her time in Moab didn't obliterate Jehovah from her thinking. She was moved back to Judah. Verse 20, Bethlehem. But in verse 21 there, she says, home. And it was never out of her I don't believe. And when we get backslid, and as you said, there's enough on us here but sound two nations tonight. But when we do need restore, I don't believe that a genuine saint, I believe from time to time, no matter how far I get away, there's stirrings. There's stirrings after Christ and the things of God, and finally
get home to the Lord. No, I can see that very, like it's what we sing in that simple little hymn. Forget and wander away, God didn't love me wherever he, back to his dear loving arms do I flee, when I remember that Jesus loves me. And Naomi's hearing that the Lord still is committed to his people and he loves them and blesses them, she says, that's where I need to be. She was like a displaced person. And she knew, I'll never be at home till I get back to my own place.
And you mentioned David, the testimony
uh-huh.
that she had with her two daughters in law. And must have, I don't know, she must have talked about what Ruth says, thy God.
Mm-hmm.
And what I didn't shout at, put it up.
Yeah.
It's not Jehovah no. there, is it?
No.
No. She says, tell me about Naomi, thy God shall be my God. So there was something always in Naomi, and it spoke to Ruth, I believe.
It reminds me a little bit of Jonah, in the sense that when Jonah was away and on the wrong track, as we know, and took the boat and so on and so forth, the sailors got saved. Jonah got restored later. He was vomited out, he went and did with the Lord. But he was in disobedience on the boat. And it was through a disobedient servant that those heathen sailors actually learned about the true God, and they offered sacrifices. So that in his disobedience, again, that's God's grace. That doesn't. So here Naomi is off track because of her husband's decision, so on and so forth, that we talked about. And yet, as we're emphasizing, her testimony. And whatever there was of God about her in her life seemed to have an impact upon these two heathen girls. Now, this is part of the story that I'm fascinated with, because where we're coming now to these different tests that she gives to these two girls. You see, there's a big controversy, and maybe we'll be into it for the last 10 minutes here, I don't know. But there's a big controversy. I would say this is one of the most controversial parts of the Book of Ruth. In this end, a great number of people, you read some books, and I've heard one or two brethren even as well, they say, like, Naomi wasn't in good shape here. She says the Lord is, what does she say in verse number 13 at the end of her section, she says, it grieveth me much that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. And she tells them here in verse number 7, verse number 8, to go back to Moab. This is not a bad advice. She's bitter. She's smarting under the fact that God has dealt with her. And telling these two girls to go back to Moab, sure, that was a disgraceful thing to do. And it shows that her heart was far away from God. And she was in a very bad condition. And that's the kind of press that poor Naomi's getting by quite a number. Now, that's one view. Now, just to show it clear where I stand, I take exactly the opposite view. I don't see a trace of that at all. I don't see that Naomi was rebelling against God, and she's mad because the Lord has taken away her two boys and her husband, and she's not pleased about it, and she doesn't want these. And they even go as far as some take that view to say, the reason she wanted the two girls to be away back to Moab was, when she landed back to Bethlehem, she didn't want to let on that her two sons had married two Moabitish girls. And she wanted to remove all evidence of the mixture in the family, so she would rather hoof it alone, rather than be seen to in some way have compromised in her separation. I see absolutely not a trace of that. You say, why do you talk about these things that she did to go back and so on and so forth? The way I read it is what I mentioned in the opening. I see Naomi as putting tests. These are two potential converts. Two potential converts. Coming to the land of the God of Israel, and Naomi knows that the only thing that will bring them there and keep them there is true faith in the God of Israel. And she tests these girls because she's a woman, and she has learned through the rigors of life. She has learned that the only thing that stands the test is reality. And she proves these girls that it's not just emotion, it's not just sentiment, it's not just friendship, it's not just feeling, it's faith. And when she had the probing done, it became obvious that as far as Orpah was concerned, that's just what it was. It was feeling and natural affection. And poor Orpah couldn't pass the test. And actually Naomi did her a favor, because if Orpah had got into the land amongst God's people, the girl would never have been happy. She never had a heart for it. And Naomi did her a favor in putting these tests on probing very, very deeply. And that's the general viewpoint that I take in these verses now for Naomi's question. So help us, brethren. Was she too severe? Was it carnal? Or did she handle the situation properly? What do our brethren think about these?
Ruth obviously has seen enough in Naomi David to convince her totally and completely that what the decision that she, that Ruth made, was the right decision.
I know it's more breaking the thing up artificially than just to try and get through it, but we'll discover tomorrow night that when Ruth passed the third test, the Bible tells us Naomi's left off speaking to her, and Naomi says, I don't know. All right, don't need to ask any more questions, don't need to present any more objections, don't need to put up any more hurdles, that girl's all right, I know she's coming. She knew when to stop. She had discernment. When reality expressed itself in Ruth's great confession that we'll be talking about in the will of God, Naomi knew enough's enough. When I have heard that, that's faith. But that's the very thing that she could never get from Orpah. There was something else in Orpah that just didn't seem to ring through, and I think Naomi proved well, so that the whole thing was just sort of, didn't take them under false pretenses or anything like that.
Well, I agree with that. All I've said about Naomi, you would think I would agree with you, do. But that is remarkable. And probably we have all talked to people who have put away to a certain extent, maybe the assembly, and when you're talking to them, and maybe I'll mention a couple of things, and then we'll say, people may say, what is she talking about, or what's she talking about, but what they're saying is right, David. And they've an insight, and what they're saying, they'll see that there, I've talked to them, and they'll say, that there's not right, and that's from people who are no longer what they know. And they have that discernment.
Yeah.
And they know, they simply know what is right or wrong, David.
Oh, surely. Surely a Naomi. And I don't see this particularly as very, very far removed here, brethren, from the ministry of the Lord Jesus. When he had the crowds following him, he said, if any man comes up, let him take up his cross. And you say, Lord, and you take. Don't. What? Sure, you never had the crowds as big and you're going to pull the bottom out of it all if you talk about carrying a cross. There's not a man around here and all these people, but his blood curdles at the very mention of the cross. Don't be talking about that, Lord. You'll chase them. And that's the very thing the Lord brought forward in his ministry. Not to chase them, but to test them. So that if you're coming here after me for comfort, he says, remember, the path that I'm trodden is a blood-stained path. It'll be reproach. And it's the same thing that... Now, she says, now listen, girls, if you're looking at home, if you're looking marriage, she says, I can't give you any prospects. You know there was a very difficult thing, and I'm not going to be the whole scolding much here. It's a very difficult thing to watch people's motives. Some people only come because of marriage or because of money or because of some material consideration. When Ruth got talking, as we'll see tomorrow night, none of those considerations, marriage and money and ease, never came into her thinking at all. She had faith, thy God shall be my God, and so on. Whereas Orpah was full of affection. She wept. She kissed her. I think Orpah was a very nice girl. A good daughter-in-law. Had been very kind. Naomi appreciated her kindness. But she knew that if she's going to come to the other land and cross the Jordan, it'll take a lot more than natural kindness to carry her. She'll need a deeper thing. And that's what Naomi was pressing for here.
Girls really with the natural affection of their mother.
Aye. I see that. I'm not interrupting us. What our brother says in verse 8, says, back to your mother. That's the natural thing to do. Nice, comfortable wee nest. We're going ahead, Graham.
Just saying that there's the natural connection. The only thing that will break that is the fear.
Aye.
And the drawing of what's in
there. I know. And then you see in the next, down a little bit later, they say, after that, they kissed and she said, oh, surely we'll go. Surely, we wouldn't think that. And then she comes in verse 11 again. She says, now, you're not to get any more husbands, or I can't have any more children. So she tested them in the past. Go back to your mother. Then she tests them in the future. She says, if you're looking a husband out of this, if you're just coming with me in the hope of getting a husband, she says, that'll not work. So the test from the past, the test of family, and the test of future romance and relationship, she tested them there, and then when that second test came in, well, I think that Orpah, they both cried again, and Orpah kissed her. But Ruth clear onto her. This quick. The two girls seem to go step by step. And then you suddenly reach a point where the two of them begin to diverge. All because Naomi, I don't know what point along the road this had happened, but some they've been on the journey some while, and Naomi had sensed that these girls are not only coming along about to say cheerio. Both these girls are intending to come the whole road with them, but they're not both ready. And we need to be careful, you know, we need to be careful how handling people here, Brennan. You don't want to be putting people off. But we don't want to invite people on false pretenses either. No, we need to be careful just so we have told people what the cost will really be and what the step will really involve.
So we can see David, one woman starting to move in fear. Ruth, starting to move in fear.
Mm-hmm.
To Judah.
Yeah.
Right. Naomi, starting to move in the restoration. And they're very similar, I would say.
Yeah.
And Naomi now is being restored. That's the way we've looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just ask you about restoration, David? Is restoration, is discipline, I'm thinking about assembly now, is it always with a view to restoration? Either God's hand,
mm-hmm.
himself, or the assembly? Is it always with a view to that one being restored? The man of 1 Corinthians 5, which I believe, anyway, I don't come back to you, it's the same man as 2 Corinthians chapter 2, I believe it's the same man,
mm-hmm.
restored. 1 Corinthians 11, many are sick and weak, and many sleep.
It wasn't with a view to restoration.
No.
We need to be careful about, generally speaking, discipline is exercised for the restoration of the offender. But there is divine discipline that can be exercised where the offender is not restored, the offender is removed. And that, I think we have that in this very chapter. Elimelech is removed. But Naomi was restored. But that really takes. So that in these three women, tell me if I'm wrong, but I see Naomi, we'll use the word that I'm not fussy about, but just a backslider being restored. Ruth is a new convert. Genuine, real. Made up her mind and so on. Orpah is what we would call in our day a false professor. Starts out on the road, wee bit like the shallow ground here, springs up very effusive, very emotional, very attached to her mother-in-law, but it really comes to the cost of it all. She just wilts and slips away back to her own country, to her own gods, and to the things that are familiar. Is there any other comments? So I'll put it this way. In the earlier part of the chapter, we have learned about the cost of disobedience. In this part of the chapter, we're learning about the cost of discipleship. Tomorrow night, in the will of God, as we see Naomi coming back the full distance, and yet with a broken heart, we learn about the cost of discipline. So as well as learning about choices in the chapter, we learn about things that are costly. And has any brother any question or any comment or to make just before we pack up?
Just on the last line or two of the first 13, it says, "For agree with me much for your sakes, that the hand of the Lord is going against me." I just been sorry that they were suffering.
I think that's it, Graham. I think that's it. Like she can see that, and she's taking responsibility for it, that the death of your father-in-law plus the death of your two husbands, like, it was a sad, the whole sad, heartbreaking situation. She says, really, listen, this whole business, these funerals that have broken her heart are a result of disobedience that I'm involved in. Wasn't you girls did anything in that sense? Because there was no famine in Moab. The famine was in Israel. God chastising his own people for the disobedience. And just across the Jordan, the grass was as green as ever it was. No famine in Moab. God's people can still be suffering when the world rejoices. God doesn't punish his people. He chastises them. But God will punish the world in a day that is yet to come. We needn't be surprised if we suffer chastisement when the world is flourishing. And that can make it tempting. People say, well, why do I stick this? And you never get your head lifted. I need to relax it a wee bit and you go out and enjoy yourself. No, that's a very, very far cry removed from the attitude of this chapter.
Yeah, but you'll allow me just a wee sort of quick question. Last week you mentioned, you haven't mentioned of teaching yet, but tapes.
Uh-huh.
Just for my own and maybe for some other saints here, tapes.
Yes.
And pictures. And you said in the book that they weren't really cast iron tapes.
Yeah, sure.
What is a tape, David? I remember a good brother saying, for to get a tape, you must have an arm and an even so. And as most of the people are certain of one, even so.
Could you
comment on what does it take?
The words used very broadly. The word used, these were in samples. The word is types in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 of all the misdemeanors. I'll just tell you this before I go. You didn't turn it up. We'll have to stop here. I promised last night I was stopping at 9, so I'm breaking the promise. The first time ever I heard ministry on the book of Ruth was by the late Mr. Fred Cundick. I'm just looking for a verse here. So we all landed that night and all ready for Ruth chapter 1, you see. So Mr. Cundick got up And he said, well, we did Lamentations. Lamentations. So, boy, that is a queer conflict. They were looking for Ruth to go to Lamentations. So he started at Lamentations. And he said, I want you to think of a name for this chapter. And he read the verse 1. How doth the city sit solitary? How is she become a widow? Then down to verse number 3. She dwelleth among the heathen. Then verse number 4. She is in bitterness. And then verse number 7. She remembered her pleasant thing. He said, what do you call that, Naomi? Naomi. Solitary, dwelling among the nations, in bitterness of soul, remembering the pleasant things. Her name means my pleasant things. And then he went on. He launched in from that in a big way, which I think is a side of it that we'll not be talking about. That Naomi is a picture of the nation of Israel. Disobedience carried away, mixing amongst the Gentiles, and eventually recovered. The Gentiles also brought into blessing, as well as Israel restored. So that the book of Ruth, as well as being a wee bit of history, it's actually a book of prophecy, predicting, foreshadowing God's dealings with his people and his dealings with the nation. Now we've exceeded the time, Brian. If some brother, if you want to sing a verse of a hymn, that's fine, and some brother, really commend us to the Lord and appreciate that.